It's time for Security Now. Birthday boy Steve Gibson is here, and we have lots to talk about. As always, the second Chrome zero-day vulnerability of 2022. We'll talk a little bit about the challenges presented to ISPs in Ukraine and the war there, and Kaspersky Labs banned by the FCC. But should you stop using it? It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 864, recorded Tuesday, March 29th, 2022. Targeted exploitation. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Grammarly. Get through those emails and your work quicker by keeping it concise, confident, and effective with Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/securitynow to sign up for a free account. And when you're ready to upgrade to Grammarly Premium, get 20% off. And by NetFoundry. Make the security of the network entirely irrelevant by isolating your applications and data with open-source embedded zero trust. Grab your free swag and free tier now by going to netfoundry.io/twit. And by Worldwide Technology and Fortinet. When was the last time your company updated your security strategy? Are your business assets protected? WWT combines strategy and execution to secure your organization and drive business outcomes. Visit wwt.com/twit to get started. It's time for Security Now with the star of the show, Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Hello, my friend. Well, we're wrapping up the first quarter of March. This is Security Now, episode 864 for March 29th. And I am now 67 years old. A big thank you for all of the very thoughtful birthday wishes last week and over the weekend.
Congratulations. I forgot to say happy birthday.
Listeners, yeah. All were appreciated. I don't feel any different. I think maybe when I hit 70, that may have an effect, but still, everything still works and I got lots of energy, so that's good. We're going to talk about targeted exploitation because Google has just suffered its second of the year zero-day vulnerability, and which is what we'll start talking about here in a minute, and it issued an out of cycle, everyone wants to call it an emergency patch, but browser update, okay, and better sooner than later. But the first zero-day vulnerability we now have thanks to a report published by their TAG, their threat analysis group, and a complete readout on what was going on with the first zero day and its use in targeted exploitations. So, we've talked about it. We've talked about how it's not really that big a deal. But the opportunity to really take a look at exactly what one of these is, I thought, was too good to pass up. So we're going to start off looking at Chrome's second zero-day vulnerability of the year, which, by the way, makes it in better shape than it was this time last year. We then spent some time with an interview of the chief technical officer of one of Ukraine's largest ISPs. And we're going to learn about the challenges that he's facing as he, works to keep the internet available, but for only some of the people who are in country. We also have JavaScript's most popular package manager, NPM, that we were just talking about, once again under attack. Oh, and Honda tells worried reporters that they have no plans to address the consequences of a new glaring security vulnerability affecting five recent years of their Honda Civic's design. We can judge for ourselves. The FCC has classified Kaspersky Lab as a national security threat, and also, which we're going to talk about, and also adds a bunch of Chinese telecom companies and services to that list as well. Then after addressing one piece of use after free listener feedback, as I said, we're going to take a detailed look at the consequences of Chrome's first zero day of the year, which they patched mid-February, and the attacks which North Korean-backed groups launched using it in some detail. So I think a great podcast for our listeners. We have a fun picture of the week, and then we'll get into it.
Nice. Nice. I want to welcome a sponsor we've had for some time onto the I think this might be their first time in Security Now, if not Grammarly. I wanted to make a special point of mentioning them because they are one of a number of Ukraine-based software companies. And, you know, now's the time to show some support. There, if you have Grammarly, you'll notice there's a message that provides resources so that you can donate to the people of Ukraine. They suspended service to Russia and Belarus right away. And they even have donated, I love this, 8 years of net revenues in Russia to Ukraine support. So they're taking all the money they made in Russia for the last 8 years, I think it's more than $4-5 million, and giving it to organizations and funds supporting the people of Ukraine. I love that. I actually love the product. So this is not in their ad, by the way. They don't want to make a big deal out of it, but I'm doing it. It's more of a news story. Now I'll do the ad, but I just really think these guys are great. I've used Grammarly forever. At first, I was one of those people who said, "Oh, I don't need a grammar checker. I can write." As soon as I started using Grammarly, I realized it's much more than a grammar checker. The name implies it's a grammar checker. No, it's a writing tool that is there to help you communicate more effectively. And you know what? I don't care how good a writer you are. Everybody needs a good editor, somebody looking over their shoulder. The free and premium features of Grammarly can save you time, give you the confidence of knowing your writing is professional. It's, as I said, free to download, very easy to integrate into your daily life. They have browser extensions. There's an app. You can even run Grammarly right from their website if you have a paragraph. In fact, this is a great way to check out Grammarly, is take some text and paste it into the Grammarly webpage, see what they suggest. It works right in Gmail, so you can work more efficiently. But the thing about Grammarly I love, And Lisa's always, she is a big Grammarly user, because Lisa is a classic chief executive, my wife and our CEO, where she's got a lot to do. She's very busy. And sometimes her emails are very short, sweet, to the point, which I admire. You know, one line, do this, fix this. Grammarly will say, you know, you might want to say, please. You might want to soften that. And she's always grateful. She always says to me, oh, yeah, I guess that was a little brusque. And it's much appreciated. That's their tone detector. And by the way, you can use this for free in the free version of Grammarly. Helps you say what you mean in an appropriate tone, depending on how it's being used, so that your message isn't misinterpreted. You know, a lot of times, because text doesn't communicate the nuances the way face-to-face expression does, it takes us a little while to get used to the idea that maybe people wouldn't understand that's our sense of humor or whatever. There are premium tone adjustments, too. They go even farther to ensure you're being clear and assertive in your emails. That's not something Lisa has a problem with. It is something I have a problem with, where it says, you might want to make this a little more clear, a little more pointed. You can persuade your audience with a confident, polished tone. It sometimes, for instance, will say, that's a little oblique, maybe a more decisive phrase would be better. And then gives you the phrase. And with one click, boom, it's in and you're done. Offers great word choices. Especially if you overuse a word, it learns and it says, you know, you say that a lot. I have a word I use way too much called, I use actually. And it's a terrible word. And thank you, Grammarly, like any good editor, says you might want to not use that this time. There's a full sentence rewrite part of premium that helps you effectively convey your ideas, avoid miscommunications, avoid those long run-on sentences, rewriting them to be more clear, more to the point. They have clarity suggestions. They'll tell you what reading grade you're writing for. And by the way, all of this is tunable depending on what you're doing. If you're writing a tweet, that's a different process than writing an email, than writing an essay, a report. And Grammarly understands that and chooses the right terminology. It's just wonderful to have, being more concise, more confident, more effective, more professional, Grammarly. Right now, if you go to grammarly.com/security now, you can sign up for that free account, get a lot of the benefits that way. If you're ready to upgrade, where you say, you know, if you say, this is really working for me, you'll get 20% off just because you're listening to Security Now. So make sure you go to grammarly.com/security now for that 20% off so they know you saw it here. It helps Steve. GRAMMARLY. There's no E in Grammarly. Grammarly.com/security now. And, you know, I think maybe we'll change the lower third to be gold and blue for the Ukraine colors, because they are really they're a company I really support. I believe in them and I like what they're doing. Grammarly.com/security. Now, picture of the week.
So I got a kick out of this one. We have some techie guy. You can see he doesn't really have a pocket protector, but he's at least got a pen stuck in his pocket, and he's standing in front of his boss's desk, and he's reporting. He says, our devices are now 100% secure. And the boss looks up from his notes and says, how did you do that? And the employee says, I turned them all off.
Yeah, so, ear gap them. That's the best way.
Or just gap them.
Gap them. Gap, gap. Plug gap them. Yeah.
Just power gap. Just pull out the cord and just weather the storm. So, as I mentioned, we have a high-severity, zero-day vulnerability update for Chrome. Last Friday, Google pushed an out-of-cycle security update to address what they considered to be a high-severity vulnerability. And, you know, I'm glad they do, because it could hurt people. It was being, you know, they're using the traditional definition of zero-day, not Microsoft's weird one. This meaning it is actually being exploited in the wild. That is, they learned of it that way. And, in fact, we'll find out about a little bit more about the way this happens at the end of this podcast. But when I was working with Chrome last night, it was at 99.0.4844.82. But when I went to go look, it goes, ooh, I got something. And so it went from 8.82 to .84. That's what this update required. And again, I'm always a little bemused by the fact that this was announced and made available on Friday. I used Chrome on Saturday and on Sunday and earlier on Monday. And it wasn't until I went to look that it said, oh, I guess since you're looking, maybe I should give you the latest. So, yeah. In March, on March 23rd, an anonymous researcher reported the bug, and to their credit, to Google's credit, 48 hours later, they were pushing out a fix. The trouble was a type confusion vulnerability in Chrome's V8 JavaScript engine, being tracked as CVE-2022-1096. And as we know, the so-called type confusion errors arise when some language atom, you know, a variable or some other object, is accessed using a type that's incompatible with what it was originally initialized to be. And in languages such as C and C++, you know, which allow for powerful implicit use and explicit type overwriting, or casting, as it's often called, this can have serious consequences. I actually do it on purpose when I know what I'm doing. I may, in assembly language, I'll declare something as a quad word and then deliberately address it in two pieces as a high and a low double word. But, you know, so there are uses for this kind of, you know, variable type casting override, but you just have to know what you're doing. Certainly in these cases, these type confusion errors are mistakes. So, you know, it is, as I said, it's possible for that to be used benignly and deliberately, but it can also be exploited by a malicious actor to perform, as was the case here, out of bounds memory access. And, you know, and now whenever I hear about something happening in Chrome's V8 engine, I'm wondering whether that cool idea that Microsoft has in Edge of disabling, like, the degree to which Chrome uses its V8 engine would have protected people from that. That would be interesting to know. Anyway, Google's acknowledged that it was, as they said, quote, aware that an exploit for CVE-2022-1096 exists in the wild, unquote. But as usual, they offered no additional specifics because they figure, why should they? And as I mentioned, so far this year, things are going better for Chrome. We're nearing the end of the third month of 2022, and this is the last podcast of the first quarter, and Chrome has only been visited by 20 days this year. There's this one, which is this type confusion error. And then the first one was, not surprisingly, this may have been what kind of has had this term on our radar. Yes, a use after free that was being exploited in Chrome's animation component, and which they patched in the middle of February. My sense is because these things generally are only being used in targeted attacks, even it appears after patches are made available. That is, you know, we've thought, well, maybe once the world knows about it, they'll start, you know, like using them on a wider scale. I just think that the window of opportunity is, you know, closes very quickly. Not as quickly as I wish it would close, because it would be great if all Chrome browsers immediately updated themselves when they got the news. But this one affects Windows, Mac, and Linux. And of course, if you're using any of the Chromium-based browsers, Edge, Opera, or Vivaldi, you'll want to apply those fixes similarly as soon as those other Chromium users offer one. And we'll get back to this at the end of the podcast, taking a look at what Google's tag team discovered about North Korea's successful use of Chrome's first zero day of the year, which was used from at least January 4th until it was spotted and then closed on the 14th, which says 42 days of active targeted exploitation of that first problem. So, and I'm also going to talk a little bit about the benefit of raising Chrome's protection to its maximum setting, even though it comes at some cost of privacy. I imagine for many users it'll be worth doing. Okay. Prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, local officials warned that Russia might try to cut Ukraine off from the internet. But even as Russian tanks were rolling into the country on February 24th, subsequent attacks, to many people's surprise, didn't have a significant effect on the country's internet. Most of Ukraine's citizens were able to remain online. And following up on our recent report of Elon Musk activating Starlink's internet service over and throughout Ukraine, and then providing what was described as a truckload of satellite uplink stations, some were questioning whether that would be it. Turns out he has followed through to deliver not only thousands more uplink stations, but now also solar battery systems. I guess an offshoot from his work with Tesla stuff. So the Starlink systems were financed by unnamed private sources, but we know that also both France and Poland contributed to the financing of Starlink to help Ukraine's connectivity. But as for Ukraine's traditional land-based infrastructure, analysts argue that Russian military may not be attacking that infrastructure because it needs the Ukrainian internet itself to stay connected to gather intelligence. Others say that Ukraine has managed to build a resilient infrastructure maintained by local ISPs. And that's also what the CTO of UKR Telecom, which is a major provider of both mobile and broadband internet in the country, said shortly before URK Telecom suffered a massive cyber attack that dramatically curtailed its service. It's just coming out of it a day or two ago. It was a DDoS attack that grew in strength over time. And I thought that the timing was interesting, that he was boasting about how they're not having any problems, and then wham. And, you know, even I learned the hard way that there's no upside whatsoever to bragging about not being DDoSed.
don't mention it. You were that way. You didn't want to talk about it. You didn't do anything about it. You just kind of kept it quiet, right?
Well, and what I realized was, you know, you and I did a number of podcasts where I'd look up and go, oh, well, you know, GRC's off the net again.
Right.
Oops. It wasn't until I took down those pages, which I originally had up, that were detailing my own adventures with DDoS attacks, even though I wasn't bragging in them, really. I mean, I was just like talking about, you know, this is what they are. When I removed those from my site, the attacks finally stopped. Like I said, no upside to saying, oh, you know, come get me. No,
don't, because don't they can't. Don't feed the trolls is the, is the rule.
Right. So anyway, URK Telecom was originally a state-owned company which controlled the country's telecommunications market. And at that time, it was maybe a little employee-heavy. 24,000 employees, which relied on old and obsolete telecom technology. 9 years ago, in 2013, the company was acquired by Ukraine's richest person. Looks like I would pronounce his name Renat Akhmatov. By 2021, the company had cut its bureaucratically oversized employee count in half, and had by 2021 203,000. Internet broadband users, bringing in a total of $33 million in annual revenue. So, a nice size ISP operating in Ukraine. During the invasion, Ukraine has worked to cut off Russian invaders from their use of their infrastructure for communication, while at the same time keeping stable internet available for those who hide in bomb shelters, study online in their basements, or want to ask their friends and relatives in the occupied territories probably the most important question, which looks like you'd pronounce it Yakti, which is Ukrainian for how are you. Anyway, the company's CTO noted that this is the second war since Russia's 2014 invasion of eastern Ukraine. He said, "We learned a lot at the time, but this war is different. People are more united." In an online interview that he conducted with The Record, which that CTO joined via Starlink, he explained how his workers are repairing internet infrastructure in the occupied territories and keeping Ukraine online, even amidst ongoing assaults by the Russian military. So The Record posted a Q&A from which I've excerpted the most interesting pieces for our audience. The Record asked, "Can Russia cut Ukraine off from the internet?" And the CTO said no. "First of all, Ukraine has a dispersed internet infrastructure, which means that key national providers, including URK Telecom, can use various routes to provide internet access." You know, and in other words, as our listeners would know, gotta love autonomous packet routing with redundant and richly interconnected links. Anyway, he continued, "Ukraine has a variety of internet service providers across the country that manage their infrastructure independently or in collaboration with others. We also have the resources and people to repair damaged infrastructure and protect the work of our networks from the working of our networks from enemies." He said URK Telecom, for example, employs 12,000 Ukrainians, of whom nearly 6,500, so a little over half, are doing technical work. He said, "Our external channels to the global internet cross Ukraine's western border, so we're not connected with Russia, which is in the east." He said, in order to completely cut Ukraine off from the internet, Russia must destroy all of the infrastructure in Ukraine, both civilian and telecommunications. The Russian military has neither the resources nor the skills, he claims, to do so. And now, of course, as we know, thanks to Starlink, it might be even a little more tricky to cut people off, because there's a lot of uplinks now to the Starlink network. The record asked, can Russian troops use the Ukrainian internet? He answered, they can if they steal mobile phones from Ukrainian citizens and connect to Ukrainian telecommunication networks. He said, we know about these cases, but they are hard to track. And of course, he's putting the best face on it possible. In other words, yes, of course, Russians are taking civilian handsets and using them for their own purposes. So anyway, he said, if the Russians manage to seize our fixed internet infrastructure, we block the equipment so they can't use it. During the war, all Ukrainian internet providers are working closely with our military and intelligence services to avoid such incidents. He said, note that there's also a very reasonable theory that Russians need Ukrainian internet services for their own purposes, either communication or intelligence gathering, like eavesdropping on phone calls. And interestingly, to secure his own conversation with Ukrainians' allies, the Ukrainian President Zelensky uses a secure sat phone that the U.S. gave the Ukrainian government a month before the invasion. So they were ready, and he has a secure means of getting, you know, of communicating with allies. So Ukrainian officials also said that Russia's own cellular handsets and networking equipment do not work properly in Ukraine, encouraging its soldiers to therefore steal mobile phones from ordinary Ukrainians. It's also possible that Russia is trying to avoid ruining the telecommunications infrastructure that it hopes it would need and be able to use if it manages to take the country, although anyone who's been keeping up with the news knows that the possibility of that happening is dwindling now by the day. It was noted that when Russian troops destroyed several 3G cell towers in Kharkiv, they could no longer use their own encrypted phones that communicate via that network. Whoops. And it turns out that rebuilding infrastructure from scratch is difficult. When Russia had illegally annexed the Crimean Peninsula in 2014, the Kremlin needed about 3 years to regain full control of that region's mobile infrastructure. So, you know, it makes sense that they would be preserving it if they think that they'll be needing it shortly. They probably learned some hard lessons from Crimea. The record asks, how accessible is UKR Telecom's internet in Ukraine now? And the CTO said, as of March 21st or 25th, rather, UKR Telecom's internet coverage stayed up to 84% of pre-war levels. He said major disruptions happen in the occupied territories where there's no electricity or where the internet infrastructure, including fiber optic underground cables, were damaged during the attacks. He said our workers make heroic efforts to provide internet access even in besieged cities. They go to the front line a few times a day, while some of them live in their cars because they have to work around the clock. We know what it's like to provide internet during a war. He said, we learned it in 2014. So we try to protect our workers from unnecessary danger. He said also during the COVID-19 pandemic, we learned to control and manage our networks remotely, even from our home offices. We have network monitoring centers throughout Ukraine, which provide real-time data on the work of each node, station, equipment, communications channels, and quality of service. It's almost impossible, he said, to find these centers because they're distributed across the country and work through the cloud. And the last question, how do competing internet providers work during the war? And he said, before the war, competition in this market was fierce. But now Ukrainian operators work as a team, not as rivals. We exchange information and resources and help each other repair damaged infrastructure. And the New York Times reported that some Ukrainian providers had been preparing ahead of the crisis by deliberately establishing fail-safe links with each other and setting up new backup network centers. The work of all operators is coordinated by a special department of the State Communication and Information Protection Service. Strong cooperation with foreign telecom operators also helps Ukraine to remain connected with the outside world. In the first days of the war, UKR Telecom reported that it had lost about 30% of their external internet channels due to damaged infrastructure, but they now have 130% of pre-war capacity. So they've built up to even more than they had before. So anyway, that was, I thought, some interesting feedback from the CTO of one of Ukraine's primary ISPs who's working hard to keep Ukrainian citizens connected while at the same time doing what they can to keep Russia and their attacking and occupying forces from using the same internet connectivity to further the Kremlin's goals. Once again, NPM is under attack. Analysts at the DevOps security firm JFrog, whom we've written about and talked about a number of times, recently blogged about their discovery of 218 malicious packages targeting the Microsoft Azure NPM scope. NPM, as we noted last week, is the Node.js package manager for JavaScript. JFrog's analysts immediately notified the NPM maintainers who removed the offending packages, 218 that they had found. JFrog's automated analyzers began alerting them to a set of packages that grew from an initial count of 50 to over 200. The unknown threat actors used typo squatting, and I'm not sure that I would use that term. That's what the tech press was reporting. I'll explain in a minute. Essentially, a naming duplication attack by attempting to trick victims into using packages that have the same name as legitimate ones. Packages are able to reuse the same names due to NPM scoping, which I'll explain in a second. JFrog said, quote, "After manually inspecting some of these packages, it became apparent that this was a targeted attack against the entire at Azure NPM scope by an attacker who employed an automatic script to create accounts and upload malicious packages that covered the entirety of the at Azure scope. Currently," they wrote, "the observed malicious payload being carried by these packages are personally identifiable information, PII stealers. The attacker seemed to target all NPM developers that use any of the packages under the Azure scope with a typo squatting attack. In addition to the at Azure scope, a few packages from the Azure-REST, Azure-Tests, Azure-Tools, and CADL-Lang scopes were also targeted. Since this set of legitimate packages is downloaded tens of millions of times per week, there's a high chance that some developers will be successfully fooled by the typo squatting attack." Okay, so the NPM documentation explains scoping as follows. They said, "When you sign up for an NPM user account or create an organization, you are granted a scope that matches your user or organization name." So, at Azure, for example. "You can use this scope as a namespace for related packages. A scope allows you to create a package with the same name as a package created by another user or organization without conflict. So, for example, you could, whereas you might have a package with a common name like Loader, if it was named at azure.loader, that would explicitly make the at Azure instance of Loader separate from all other NPM packages that might have, you know, and the name of Loader. Excuse me. So when listed as a dependent in a package.json file, scoped packages are preceded by their scope name. The scope name is everything between the at sign and the slash. Oh, so it's a slash, not a dot. So it'd be at Azure slash Loader, for example. Okay, so the individuals behind the attack sought to obscure the fact that the packages all came from the same author by using randomly generated names to create unique users for each uploaded malicious package. JFrog also noted that the attacker sought to specifically go after machines and developers running from internal Microsoft Azure networks. They wrote, quote, "We suspect that this malicious payload was either intended for initial reconnaissance on vulnerable targets, for example, before sending a more substantial payload, or as a bug bounty hunting attempt against Azure users and possibly Microsoft developers," unquote. JFrog also suggested that developers make sure their installed packages are the legitimate ones by checking that their name starts with the at Azure scope. In other words, don't be lazy about that. Any results that don't start with an at Azure scope may have been affected successfully by this attack. In other words, from a developer standpoint, any developer who may have not been explicitly scoping their package dependencies with the at Azure in order to specify, you know, reusing my example, you know, the at Azure loader package may have inadvertently picked up one of these 218 mildly malicious, non-scoped, same-named packages instead. So the attack was the use of same-named, non-scoped packages. And JFrog found that there were about 50 downloads per package, that is, per 218 of these package, meaning that while none were downloaded in huge numbers, the non-scoped attack was somewhat effective, and it would have been much worse if JFrog hadn't picked up on it so quickly. So cool that they've got some automated analyzers that are apparently like looking at everything that is added to the NPM repository and immediately said, hey, wait a minute, these things have the same name as some at Azure things. That could be a problem. As for how to avoid this sort of supply chain dependency attack, the JFrog researcher said that developers should use automatic package filtering as part of a secure software curation process. They said, quote, "What's alarming about this attack is this is a package that is downloaded tens of millions of times each week, meaning there is a high chance many developers will be fooled." As we know from having talked about it before, typo squatting was originally coined. The term typo squatting originally coined due to its use in domain name space to make a website or email look like it's from a trustworthy source. The fact that we're now seeing a related attack seeping into the supply chain suggests how dependent software is today on third-party packages, and of course, think no further than Log4j, and that this has become so widespread today that threat actors are now seeing this kind of attack as a viable vector. It's long been common practice to sanitize user inputs being accepted by an application. What's becoming clear is that in today's composite application assembly environment, it's also becoming every bit as necessary to sanitize the back-end build process as well. Those in the industry have noted that the likelihood of a successful attack varies depending upon how much control the maintainers of a repository have. In many cases, packages are signed and only known members of a development team are able to perform such maintenance functions. In NPM's case, and many others, end users are able to offer up modules. And think no further than WordPress. What could possibly go wrong there? And the vetting of these modules from a security perspective will vary by the package manager. In this particular case, due to sheer volume of NPM users, it's likely the attack was successful across many machines. Based on the nature of the attack, it's more likely to affect new users of NPM, but even experienced developers could be affected if they failed to pay close attention to the name of a specific package they're installing. Given how quickly the maintainers took down the malicious content, the overall impact of the community, as we know, was limited this time. So, you know, my feeling is all of this should be sending up bright red warning flares about just how brittle our community-sourced supply chain environment has become. You know, we've got many years of sort of implicit trust here, and we know things are slow to change. Well, the bad guys have figured out supply chain is a, you know, a big chunk of low-hanging fruit. So it's becoming clear that insufficient attention has been given to true security here, or at least that security has taken a back seat to convenience. And that's not a safe place to be moving forward. We're going to talk about a shocking decision that Honda's engineers made, Leo.
I am shocked, I tell you.
You're going to be, let me tell you, you will be shocked. I need to wet my vocal cords.
You came to the desert to take the waters, and now you're shocked that we are in a desert. But no, in fact, you can have some water. Well, I want you to listen, though, because I want you to correct me if I get anything wrong. It's time to talk about NetFoundry. And you know, when I think about zero trust architectures and what NetFoundry is doing with OpenZD, I think about you, because I think about the thing that you always taught people with Shields Up, which is it is better if you're a device on the network to be stealth, not to close the doors, but not even to respond, right? We've talked a lot about VPNs on this show, how you can encrypt traffic once it leaves your network so nobody can see it. But ultimately, and this is something I think, I don't know, I feel like Google was certainly where I first became aware of the notion of zero trust. But the idea that nothing, even on your internal network, is trusted until it proves who it is a very powerful idea in security. So that's, if I'm going to put it in a nutshell, in a layman's terms, that's kind of what OpenZD is all about.
TNO.
TNO. TNO, you kind of coined this idea. If you're looking for a way to stop DDoS attacks or credential stuffing or brute force or exploits or, you know, zero days BGP hijacks, there is a way, a zero trust way, to isolate your applications, your data, making the security of your network completely irrelevant. You could open it all wide up. Because of zero trust. Trust no one. OpenZD was created and is maintained by NetFoundry. It is an open source project. Now, there are reasons why you might want to use NetFoundry services, and I'll explain that in a second. But this is the next generation of secure open source networking for your applications. With OpenZD, you can spin up a truly private, zero trust overlay network across anything. You can do it in the app. You can do it on a device. You can do it on a cloud. You can do it internally. It's because it's open source. It's built on, you know, developer fundamentals that you will recognize of extensibility and flexibility and scalability. You know, you get end-to-end encryption. I'm not talking a VPN.
I'm talking about something much more sophisticated. A scalable, pluggable networking mesh, built-in smart routing, and client proof of identity using certificates, strong crypto. It is just, to me, you know, once I started to understand all this, I was so impressed. It works with C, with Go, with Swift, Android, Java, Node.js, C#, .NET. You can build your own network if you want. You can use it as a SaaS using NetFoundry's foundations. So, you know, in fact, a good way to get your feet wet is to go through NetFoundry. It gives you everything you need to spin up a truly private, zero-trust overlay network. Your apps suddenly have superpowers with the OpenZD SDK. It's a really nice SDK. Just a few lines of code. Or you can use their tunnelers to spin up zero-trust networking in minutes across any cloud or device. Using OpenZD isolates your apps and systems. So if you need to explain this to the higher-ups, essentially, they're not subject to external network-level attacks. It's just not possible from malicious actors. You protect from internal or even OS networks, immune to network side-channel attacks like phishing. It is simpler, really, because you don't have to worry about patching, or, you know, reactive patching. The design patterns they use are completely agnostic, so essentially, it's commodity internet with outbound ports without needing any special skills to implement it. No big firewall rules, anything like that. Or, you know, you say goodbye to inbound ports and public DNS or VPNs. The other thing you'll love about this, it eliminates the tug of war between developers who want freedom and expressiveness, right? And security that wants to lock everything down, because developers can work with the software programmatically. And the security folks know that, you know, they have the peace of mind knowing that their apps are isolated, driven by policy, visibility, and logs that are required. Look, this is a complex subject, but this is state of the art now on how to protect your apps, your network, your devices. It's zero trust. It's a journey, so start wherever you need based on your priorities. OpenZD offers numerous SDKs, tunneling apps for popular OSs, edge routers, and cloud marketplaces. So you can host it, yes, but you don't have to. You can use the NetFoundry SaaS. And by the way, if you just want to get your feet wet, they have free forever tiers with up to 10 endpoints, which actually for a lot of people is all you need. It reminds me a little bit, and I'm no expert in this, but of how much we loved Himachi, right? Because you could create kind of a private tunneled network of your own. This is Himachi on steroids. This is like amazing stuff. I want you to learn about it. Go to NetFoundry. Again, they created it. They support it. They maintain it. That's another thing. I think sometimes people go, I don't want to do it open source because, you know, some guy in his mom's basement supporting them. No. You've got a great company behind this doing a really fantastic job with it. If you go to netfoundry.io/twit, and please do that so they know you saw it here, netfoundry.io/twit. They've got some free swag. You can, you know, get some stickers for your laptop or whatever, but also take a look at the free tier, up to 10 endpoints, free forever. It's open source, Apache 2.0. They've got fully programmable REST APIs for management. As I said, the SDKs are in any language pretty much that you'd want to use. It's incredible. You can do so much with it. It's so flexible, so expressive. I think you're going to really be impressed. And I know when it, you know, you first say zero trust, you go, oh, no, that's for Google. No, it's not. It's for you. I want you to check it out. OpenZD. It's got a great name. NetFoundry.io. NetFoundry.io/twit to learn more. We're really thrilled, actually, to have NetFoundry on the show because this is a solution that is superb. And it belongs right here on Security Now. Steve, fully hydrated. He's gone to Morocco, seeking the waters. Or Casablanca. He's in Casablanca, seeking the waters. What's next?
So, it's been a while since we've talked about automotive vehicle security, or lack thereof. Okay, so first, our longtime listeners will recall our coverage of Sammy Kamkar and his development of what he named the Roll Jam attack. Back then, and I think it was 2015, Sammy demonstrated a $30 device that was capable of sniffing and jamming a car's constantly changing rolling codes. And we're talking about, like, for the remote, you know, door open, car starts, and like, trunk open stuff, right? Which, as we know, many car manufacturers use to unlock and start their vehicles, and also to open garage doors. Sammy's roll jam system was effective against both Microchip Technologies named Keylock, K-E-E-L-O-Q, Keylock Access Control System, and also the so-called High Security Rolling Code Generator, which was being produced by National Semi. And since it was able to subvert either of those two most popular technologies, it gave its perpetrator access to vehicles made by Chrysler, Daewoo, Fiat, GM, Honda, Toyota, Volvo, Volkswagen, Jaguar, and those using third-party add-on security systems from Clifford and Sherlock. And it was also effective against a wide variety of garage door openers, which all used the same chips made by Microchip and National Semi. Okay, now, as we know, rolling codes are similar to the pseudo-random numbers produced by today's six-digit one-time password, right? Or TOTP, time-based authentication systems. But those systems encrypt a sequential counter, rather, that is, the one-time, like the rolling codes, encrypt a sequential counter rather than a time-of-day clock. Both sequential counter and time-based systems are designed specifically, you know, what they're used for is to thwart replay attacks. Unlike a password, which is inherently susceptible to replay attack, you get someone's password, you just use it, right? Not so with these one-time tokens. In the case of a counter-based scheme, a legitimate rolling code is valid only until it is received by the lock, which then advances its own internal counter to expire the code which it just received, which also prepares it to receive the next expected code. What Sammy demonstrated to the world back in 2015 was that the system was cute, but that it was not strong enough to stand up to an active attacker. And what Sammy came up with was kind of brilliant. This his little $30 device would be placed somewhere near a locked car or garage. When its owner attempted to unlock their car, Sammy's gadget would receive and store the first code while also jamming its reception to block it from working. So the car's owner would think, huh, and push the unlock button to try again. The second time, Sammy's device would again receive and block the reception of the second code. But then it would immediately forward the first code it had intercepted the first time, thus unlocking the car or opening the garage as its owner expected. The first code would work because the car or the garage door opener had been blocked from receiving it the first time, right? Which would leave Sammy's device holding the second and still unused code, which the receiving device would now be primed to expect, and which could then be used to place its owner's, you know, in place of its owner's unlocking key, which I just think is so clever, you know. And Sammy's been around a long time. He's done all kinds of cool hacks like this. Okay, so that was then. Way back in 2015, what lessons have been learned since? As it turns out, sadly, not nearly as much as we would hope. Some student researchers and their associates at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, used a small assortment of off-the-shelf, widely available components to examine the signal being produced by Honda's vehicle unlock and remote start technology. They used the HackRF1 SDR, you know, SDR, software defined radio, with a laptop, an account on fccid.io, and GQRX's SDR receiver software with the GNU radio development toolkit. Just, you know, basically just assemble the off-the-shelf pieces. What they discovered stunned them. The remote keyless system in Honda Civics, made for 5 years from 2016 through 2020, encompassing the Honda Civic models LX, EX, EX-L, Touring, SI, and Type R, all share the same remote keyless entry and engine start system. And the keys for all of those cars, produced for 5 years, emit an unchanging, fixed for that car signal, encoded using frequency shift keying, you know, FSK, over a carrier at 433.215 megahertz, standard 433 megahertz frequency. The key's various functions, such as door unlock, trunk unlock, and engine start, each emit different codes. But the codes for each function, it's hard for me even to believe it, never change. Okay, this means, and there are now multiple GitHub videos showing this, successful unlocking and starting of these Honda Autos can be achieved simply by replaying the same signals that were earlier produced by and recorded from the key. So, what we've had during the intervening years appears to be a significant drop in deployed vehicle security, presumably because nobody was looking and there was no one to hold vehicle manufacturers accountable. Okay, you know, the multiple implications of this are obvious, I'm sure, to our listeners. If someone's key was found while they were at a party or at the gym or wherever, its various signals could be recorded, you know, kind of offline, as it were, and then replayed at any later time forever to gain access to the vehicle and even to remotely start its engine. Well, remotely, meaning, you know, outside of the car. Or the key's signal could be captured and recorded near the vehicle when the key is being used in, for example, an employee parking lot. And then the next day, when the vehicle is locked and unattended, it could be readily unlocked and entered. You know, unlike, for example, the use of a Slim Jim, one of those super thin, you know, aluminum strips with a hook at the end used to unlock a car, which would make any thief quite conspicuous. Anyone watching a remote radio attack, even a police officer, would see the car unlock itself as the thief casually approached and entered the vehicle, and, you know, reasonably assuming that the car's owner had just approached and entered.
It would help if the thief goes, oh, oh, as he gets in. Just, you know, just to simulate.
Actually, I think the car probably makes that sound.
Right, it would, because it doesn't know, does it?
Yeah, it has no idea. It's the same signal that right. The key emits. Okay, despite this, a spokesman for Honda said they had no plans to update their older vehicles, even after researchers released their comparatively trivial proof of concept for this glaring design failure, also now known as CVE 2022-27254. When contacted and asked about this issue, Honda spokesperson Chris Martin said, "It is not a new discovery and doesn't merit any further reporting," unquote. Yeah, and please stop talking about it. Martin confirmed that, quote, "legacy technology utilized by multiple automakers may be vulnerable to, quote, determined and very technologically sophisticated thieves, unquote. The trouble is, as we've so often seen, what may have required sophistication at the turn of the century is now available using plug-it-together, off-the-shelf technology. A precocious student in elementary school could pull this off.
Wow.
Amazing. Honda's Chris Martin added that, quote, Honda has not verified the information reported by researchers. Yeah, and they don't want to. And continuing the quote, and cannot confirm if its vehicles are vulnerable to this type of attack. Honda has no plan to update older vehicles at this time, and there is no indication that the type of device in question is widely used, unquote. Widely used? Okay. How would there be an indication? You know, you want thieves to voluntarily confess? Yeah, I did that. Worked great. Okay. One has to wonder whether Honda owners might get together in a large, dare I say, class and take some action about the fact that the security of the vehicles Honda has sold them as recently as 2 years ago is so readily compromised. Amazing. Like, you know, it's magic, right? You press the button and your car unlocks.
How is this different from what we've talked about before? I mean,
it's like way lower tech, Leo. Like before, you had to be like the car sent your key fob a signal,
right?
And then the key fob had to echo. This is just a blind transmission of a fixed code. You know, it's like the remote control on your TV.
Oh, that's terrible.
It is awful.
Is it only Honda? Does anybody else use this?
That's a really good question.
Because I doubt it. Honda is the only one, right? It's probably...
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... I mean, and the problem now is it's now public knowledge. It's getting a lot of press. Everybody knows it. We know that Honda's from year 2013 through... 2016 through 2020, 5 years of Honda Civics... All you have keys with a static code. You simply record the code once, and then you play it back anytime you want. It's just...
That's terrible.
It's unconscionable.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, sure. Maybe it's true that any of these things can be defeated, and we've talked about them. But doing it is typically so burdensome that, you know, bad guys don't try. It matters how high the bar is, you know, and I didn't put it in the show notes, but Martin also said, yeah, you know, there's like Slim Jims that can be used to unlock doors. It's like, hello. Yes. But the thief has, you know, is exposed while they're doing it, you know, and so they don't do it. This makes it just, you know, falling off a log easy.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, the U.S., the FCC, Kaspersky Labs, and Chinese telecoms are all mixed up. Last Friday, in an announcement titled FCC Expands List of Equipment and Services That Pose Security Threat, unquote, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission added the well-known to us Russian cybersecurity firm Kaspersky to its covered list, believing that the use of Kaspersky Lab products poses unacceptable risks to U.S. national security. The coverage includes information, the Kaspersky's information security products, solutions, and services supplied by Kaspersky or any linked companies, including subsidiaries or affiliates. And the same day, last Friday, the HackerOne bug bounty program also terminated their relationship with Kaspersky. HackerOne's decision to disable Kaspersky's bug bounty program follows the news that Germany's Federal Office for Information Security, known as BSI, had warned companies against using Kaspersky products. The German regulator indicated that Russian authorities could force the AV provider into allowing Russian intelligence to launch cyber attacks against its customers or have its products used for cyber espionage campaigns. Just to be clear, this is all entirely without any precipitating evidence and only out of an abundance of caution. Kaspersky responded by writing, "Kaspersky is disappointed with the decision by the Federal Communications Commission to prohibit certain telecommunications-related federal subsidies from being used to purchase Kaspersky products and services. This decision is not based on any technical assessment of Kaspersky products that the company continuously advocates for, but instead is being made on political grounds. Kaspersky maintains that the U.S. government's 2017 prohibitions on federal entities and federal contractors from using Kaspersky products and services were unconstitutional, based on unsubstantiated allegations and lacked any public evidence of wrongdoing by the company. And there has been no public evidence to otherwise justify those actions since 2017, and the FCC announcement specifically refers to the Department of Homeland Security's 2017 determination as the basis for today's decision. Kaspersky believes today's expansion of such prohibition on entities that receive FCC communications-related subsidies is similarly unsubstantiated and is a response to the geopolitical climate rather than a comprehensive evaluation of the integrity of Kaspersky's products and services. Kaspersky will continue to assure its partners and customers on the quality and integrity of its products, and remains ready to cooperate with U.S. government agencies to address the FCC's and any other regulatory agency's concerns. Kaspersky provides industry-leading products and services to customers around the world to protect them from all types of cyber threats, and it has stated clearly that it doesn't have any ties with any government, including Russia's. The company believes that transparency and the continued implementation of concrete measures to demonstrate its enduring commitment to integrity and trustworthiness to its customers is paramount." Unquote. Now, I completely agree that Kaspersky has never given us any cause to mistrust them. But that's not the question or the problem. That's a misdirection, I think, that misses the point. And they know what the point is. Where they are is the point. So I'm not sympathetic to Kaspersky's plight. None of this should have been a surprise to them. It's been their conscious choice to remain operating in Russia for the past 8 years, since 2014. After their president and country illegally invaded Ukraine and annexed its Crimean Peninsula. And being in Russia, they know far more than we do how their country is being run and has been acting. We know that not everyone in Russia agrees with Putin, and I don't doubt that Kaspersky would resist and fight any subversion of their integrity. That's all they have, and that's a lot to lose. But given everything we've seen recently, it might not be their choice. And that's the point. Given the awesome networking power that a deeply trusted and embedded company such as Kaspersky wields, and in the context of an authoritarian regime which is increasingly acting as if it has nothing left to lose, there's every reason to worry that Kaspersky's employees could be forced to act against their will. So it's not Kaspersky for a moment that I don't trust. It's their ruthless and immoral government that ultimately controls them, which we cannot afford to trust in this instance.
And there are plenty of good, maybe even better, choices in the world. It's not like they have
exactly.
Now, I have to point out that Kaspersky got his technical education from the KGB Higher School, which prepares intelligence officers for the Russian military and KGB. He has a degree from there in mathematical engineering and computer technology. He served in the Soviet military intelligence service as a software engineer. And he met his wife at a KGB vacation resort 2 years before he founded Kaspersky Antivirus. I'm not saying, I mean, here's part of the problem is everybody loves Eugene because he's a very good salesman. And he goes around and he goes to conferences and stuff and, you know, he buys people drinks. Dvorak used to swear by Kaspersky, probably because he used to hang with Eugene.
Yep.
I don't know. I think there's no evidence, but there's enough smoke.
And your point, Leo, is why take the risk? Well,
you don't have to, so why? And all this, by the way, is saying you can't use government subsidies to buy Kaspersky.
Right. Right.
And by the way, you can't buy a lot of Russian stuff right now, not because they're inherently insecure, but because it's money to Russia. So yep. I don't think this is a bridge too far.
Yeah. But. And, you know, from my standpoint, there's no way I would feel completely comfortable right now if my computer was running software that was routinely phoning home to Russia. That just, yeah. You know,
seems a bad idea.
We're waiting for the big cyber attack.
And they were implicated in the leak of the NSA hacking tools.
Yes,
whether intentionally or not, they were involved.
Yep. Which is not to say that other AV might not have also been doing the same thing, but you know, theirs went to Russia.
So anyway,
and you know, it, for what it's worth, Kaspersky has not been singled out for this treatment, at least not globally. Last week's decision to designate Kaspersky as a national security threat follows previous decisions to ban and revoke China Unicom America's license over serious national security concerns in January of this year. And 2.5 weeks ago, the FCC added the Chinese telecommunications companies Huawei, ZTE, Hytera Communications, Hikvision, and Dahua to its ban list. Back in June of 2020, Huawei and ZTE were designated national security threats to the integrity of the U.S. communications networks or the communications supply chain. And now the Chinese state-owned mobile service providers China Mobile International USA and China Telecom Americas have been added as well. So, you know, tensions are running high. And, you know, Leah, we're in this weird world of deep economic codependency with those we do not trust. It's freaky. I mean, I don't think I have anything. I don't think I own anything that didn't come from China.
It's all made in China, baby, yeah.
Yet, you know, here we are, you know, and how many times have I talked about our IoT stuff?
Right.
You know, all my lights and plugs and things turn on and off because they're connecting to Chinese cloud services.
I actually think that's a good thing, not from a security point of view, but from a global economic perspective.
I do too.
Interdependence is good for peace.
Yes.
And if we weren't so interdependent, we couldn't sanction Russia to the degree we have.
Yes.
And obviously, it's not enough to stop them, but.
Well, it's not enough to stop one man.
Right.
And I think
that's the problem.
That's the problem, is that this guy is, you know, believed to be the richest person in the world. You know, nothing. He doesn't care at this point. And there are no handles on him. There's nothing we can do.
Right.
And so we'll see what happens.
But, yeah.
Yikes. Austin Wise tweeted me from at Austin Wise. He said, on the most recent Security Now episode, the phrase use after free was overloaded. And he means overloaded in the object-oriented sense, to mean both using a pointer after calling free and a language runtime gets confused about the lifetime of garbage-collected memory. For the second case, he says, the .NET developers call it a GC hole, GC as in garbage collection, a GC hole. The runtime normally keeps track of memory, but if it falls into a GC hole, it can get lost and freed too early. He says section 2.1 of this guide has more details about GC holes in .NET. And then I have a link in the show notes, which he provided. He said, I think a phrase like GC hole could make it more clear when talking about these sorts of use after free problems. Anyways, I love the show. Thanks for helping everyone know how computers work and how they break. And so that's what he wrote. Austin, thank you. He's correct that the phrase use after free was overloaded. And that was the point I was hoping to make. You know, much like someone saying that the security vulnerability allowed for security protections to be bypassed. You know, gee, thanks for the clarification. We've seen that in vulnerability reports, the term use after free has similarly become a catch-all for any use of memory by any means whatsoever when that memory is no longer allocated. You know, last week we talked about how one obvious source of such error is a programmer whose code on their behalf makes that mistake by explicitly freeing something that can later be referenced. The link Austin provided to the GitHub page regarding Microsoft's .NET Common Language Runtime offered a nice bit of detail about the challenges on the automatic garbage collection side. And so I did want to share a couple of paragraphs from that. It reads, So this is written to .NET coders asking, is your code GC safe? And then it says, how GC holes are created? And it says, the term GC hole refers to a special class of bugs that bedevils the CLR, meaning the common language runtime. You know, that's like the, you know, like the Java VM, right? It's the thing that reads the intermediate language. They say the GC hole is a pernicious bug because it is easy to introduce by accident, repros rarely, meaning, you know, reproduces rarely, and is very tedious to debug. A simple GC hole can suck up weeks of dev and test time. One of the major features of the CLR is the garbage collection system. That means that allocated objects, as seen by a managed application, are never freed explicitly by the programmer. Instead, the CLR periodically runs a garbage collector. The GC discards objects that are no longer in use. Also, the GC compacts the heap to avoid unused holes in memory, known as heap fragmentation. Therefore, a managed object does not have a fixed address. Objects move around according to the whims of the garbage collector. To do its job, the GC must be told about every reference to every GC object. The GC must know about every stack location, every register, and every non-GC data structure that holds a pointer to a GC object. These external pointers are called root references. Armed with this information, the GC can find all objects directly referenced from outside the GC heap. With these objects may in turn reference other objects, which in turn reference other objects, and so on. By following these references, the GC finds all reachable live objects. All other objects are by definition unreachable and therefore discarded. After that, the GC may move the surviving objects to reduce memory fragmentation. If it does this, it must, of course, update all existing references to the moved object. Any time a new object is allocated, a GC may occur. GC can also be explicitly requested by calling the garbage collect function directly. garbage collections do not happen asynchronously outside these events, but since other running threads can trigger garbage collections, your thread must act as if garbage collections are asynchronous unless you take specific steps to synchronize with the garbage collection. More on that later. And don't worry, we won't get there. Finally, a garbage collection hole occurs when code inside the common language runtime creates a reference to a garbage collection object, neglects to tell the garbage collector about that reference, performs some operation that directly or indirectly triggers a garbage collection, then tries to use the original reference. At this point, the reference points to a garbage memory to garbage memory, and the common language runtime will either read out a wrong value or correct whatever that reference is pointing to. Whew. So I liked that just because it should give everybody a sense for how much machination is going on invisibly behind the scenes and how excruciatingly easy it is for the automatic runtime garbage collector to get out of sync with the program's use of variables. I mean, the fact that people even tried to do this, to me, is mind-boggling. And yes, I am staying with assembly language, which has no garbage to collect.
Hey, you said something earlier about typecasting in assembly language. You don't even have types, really.
Yeah.
Does the assembler respect types? And you could say this is...
Yes.
But it's really how big a register it needs or like that, right? How much of the register it's going to use?
And structures are types.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So a float you have to represent differently than an integer. And a 32-bit integer can be represented in a 32-bit integer in a 32-bit register. So but sort example, of types.
But okay, so for example, say that there's something that I want to refer to sometimes as a word and sometimes as a double word, for convenience.
Right.
Because, for example, so a word
but
is 16 bits.
Hardware dependent. Yes,
a word is 16 bits, a double word is 32 bits.
On x86.
On x86.
Yeah.
So I really only want to use 16 bits, but I may want to load this thing into a 32-bit register. So what I'll declare, and I do this in SpinWrite, is I'll declare something as a word, you using DW, declare word.
Yeah.
And then I'll have then I'll say 0, 0. So I'm actually declaring two words.
Two. Yeah.
So I've reserved 32 bits. But the Intel instruction set is a little endian instruction set, so the least significant bytes come first, which means that I can refer to that location as a word, but I can also load it into a 32-bit register because that second word will be the high half of the 32 bits.
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
Exactly. But in the assembler, if I try to use a move instruction, I'll say move, EAX, comma, and then the name of that variable, it'll complain. Because I've declared that as a word, and I'm trying to load it into EAX.
A double word register.
Yes. So what I can do is, well, actually, there is an instruction for zero extending a 16-bit into 32, so I could do that. But I could also say move EAX, comma, D word pointer, and then the name. So what I've done is I've overridden the word sizeness of that and said to the assembler, trust me, baby, I got this. This is a D word. And so the assembler doesn't complain. It says, okay, and it loads the 32 bits that are there. So
it's really because the assembler is doing some type checking.
Yeah, it is a strongly typed assembler.
I would never have thought of that. I mean, you don't, that's, are you using MASM still? What are you using?
Yeah, Masm. Yeah. I'm still.
So that's a feature of Masm. But I mean, if you're really hand coding assembly, you do whatever the hell you want, right? I mean,
oh, and Leo,
the microcode isn't doing type checking. Or is it?
No, the microcode does not.
It doesn't
care. All in the. It's
you
all
tell
in
me
the
to put that in the EAX register. I'm going to put it there.
It's just an aid to the programmer, and I have to tell you, it's helped. It's caught me.
Oh, sure.
A number of times where I'll just like do something, and then I'll go. I go. Oh, that's right. That's a word, and so it's very useful to have that.
It's interesting. Yeah, I heard you say that, and I thought, wait a minute. How would you typecast an assembly? Well, you can.
And Leo, we can take our break before we talk about targeted exploitation.
Ooh, heavy duty stuff. Let's talk about
Day in Chrome.
Yeah, WWT, Worldwide Technology, and Fortinet. WWT, as you, I'm sure, know, they're the enterprise hardware and software gurus. They offer security solutions and services to protect your businesses. And of course, as you know, if you listen to the show, the bad guys are constantly updating their strategy, constantly moving. I hope you are. WWT can help your organization prepare and combat those next gen threats. Be ready for whatever comes down the pipe. You really do want to work with WWT. You need a company that has the vision, the services, the capabilities needed to deliver security controls to reduce the risk for your organization. But you also want a company, an enterprise partner, that understands business. They're not technology for technology's sake. They know that whatever technology you use has to support your business, your strategy, your goals. And that's why it's a great partner for you, because they do that. They're business people themselves. They understand. They focus really hard. I know their executives are constantly learning, taking classes, training, talking to one another, talking to enterprise companies to really understand something that's evolving probably just as quickly as the bad guys, today's enterprise businesses. Enterprise technology is the bread and butter for WWT. Their team has the resources and the platforms, the hardware and the software to completely protect your organization. And with three decades of experience, they have proven track records to help you succeed. Whether you're the large healthcare organization that they came in and they did an analysis for, and because they wanted to move to an electronic health record technology. Actually, this is from a reference on their website. Well-known company. I'm not going to name names, but you know who they are. 90% after they did all the analysis, the expert knowledge, state-of-the-art tools, in-depth analysis, 90% of the vulnerabilities they found, and there were some, could be fixed and kept fixed by putting in a comprehensive systematic approach to patching. So they implemented that. But that's not all. They don't just say, okay, thank you very much, and leave. They stuck around to do skilled training and repetition for the employees and the staff to make sure it would always be secure. They're partners. That's the point. They're not just geeks. They're business people who partner with you to make your business work better. Like that retail bank that wanted infrastructure that could survive a catastrophic cybersecurity event, a giant ransomware attack, for instance. WWT came in. Of course, they locked everything down, but they were also able to, just as a side benefit, reduce system outages by 40%. They reduced costs by 48% by automating infrastructure. WWT is a company that helps you holistically because they see your business as a business, not just a bunch of technologies. Risk management, endpoint security, network security, identity and access management, cloud security. WWT can help you in every area, work with you to make your business safer, more secure, more reliable, and ultimately more profitable, because that's what we're all there for. Go see how WWT at Fortinet can protect your business assets, protect your intellectual property with the holistic security approach that works for today and for tomorrow. WWT.com/twit to get started. Let Worldwide Technology help you. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide Technology makes a new world happen. WWT. All right. Back of the book, sort of. Let's talk about the topic of the week.
So I thought that the term targeted exploitation was a little more catchy than calling the podcast The Exploitation of CVE-2022-0609.
Now, I bet Volno and him has a good name for it, I'm sure. Let me look it up.
I bet they do, yes. You know, Itchy Camel or something.
Oh. I'm going to look it up while you go on.
Okay. So let's talk about last month's Chrome Use After Free exploitation. Last week on Thursday, the day before Google pushed their second urgent update to Chrome, their tag team, you know, the threat analysis group, provided some very interesting information about their detection of attacks which were leveraging that first zero day that was closed mid-February by their first urgent update of the year. Since, except in the case of Microsoft, we're almost always talking about vulnerabilities in the past tense, I thought it would be interesting to take a closer look into a case study of targeting. You know, we're often talking or taking an appropriate, what I think is an appropriate relaxed stance toward the need to update when something will almost certainly only be used against specific targets, since what are the chances that that's us? But I think this case history should serve to provide a useful reminder of what can actually happen and also, you know, what targeting really looks like. On February 10th, the threat analysis group discovered two distinct North Korean government-backed attacker groups exploiting a remote code execution vulnerability in Chrome, which was given CVE-2022-0609. These groups' activity has been publicly tracked as Operation Dream Job and Operation Apple Juice, J-E-U-S.
Oh, Lord.
You know, I think they are taking some hints from the Volnonym.
Yeah,
people,
I can't find it. There's so many Volnonyms.
Oh, God, they're so bad.
They need a search engine at Volnonym.
So we observed that campaigns targeting U.S.-based organizations, says Google, speaking of themselves, Google says we observed the campaigns targeting U.S.-based organizations spanning news media.
Here it is. Trollopian Bomdi. That's not any better.
Trollopian Bomdi.
Oh, wait a minute. That's 2020-0609. Sorry. I got to get 2022-0609.
Okay.
Very confusing, I tell you. I'll keep looking.
Okay. So Google observed the campaigns targeting U.S.-based organizations spanning news media, IT, cryptocurrency, and financial technology industries. They said, however, other organizations and countries may have been targeted as well. One of the campaigns has direct infrastructure overlap. No?
They have no name for it. For it.
I'm not
get
impressed.
Going, Volnonym. Get off.
And, you know, I'm still following that ridiculous thing.
Oh,
and
I do,
so
too.
Every so often I look hysterical at what they're coming up with. It's just nuts. It's like, turn that off.
They do, it turns out, have a search engine at volnonym.org. But they haven't named that. So, you know, come on. This is a big CVE, dudes.
Yeah.
That's shocking.
That's why we're talking about it. So, Google found out about this on February 10th, patched it on February 14th of this year. So 4 days later, again, props to Google for responding so quickly. They said that the earliest evidence we have of this exploit kit being actively deployed is January 4th, 2022. So of course, what happened was once they saw it and understood what was happening, they were able to look back in logs and realize, ooh, we didn't know what that was, but that was happening back as far back as January 4th. So in other words, 42 days that this was going on. They said, we suspect that these groups work for the same entity with a shared supply chain, meaning, you know, malicious supply chain, hence the use of the same exploit kit. But each operate with a different mission set and deploy different techniques. They said it's possible that other North Korean government-backed attackers have access to the same exploit kit as well. In this blog, they said, we will walk through the observed tactics, techniques, and procedures, and we now have an abbreviation for that, right? TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures, share relevant IOCs, and that's indications of compromise, and analyze the exploit kit used by the attackers. In line with our current disclosure policy, we are providing these details 30 days after the patch release. In other words, we're sure by now this update has leaked out to all of instances of Chrome, so we can talk about it. The campaign, consistent with Operation Dream Job, targeted over 250 individuals working for 10 different news media, domain registrars, web hosting providers, and software vendors. In other words, they know who these people are, right? And we've talked in the past that Google will reach out and contact these entities when they identify them to say, you should know that maybe you clicked a bum link and, you know, think about that. They said the targets received emails claiming to come from recruiters at Disney, Google, and Oracle with fake potential job opportunities. The emails contain links spoofing legitimate job hunting websites like Indeed and ZipRecruiter.
Our sponsor. Wow.
And note, I've got a screenshot of one of these emails, and it's got the padlock, HTTPS, and the URL reads IndeedUS.org, which is not the legitimate domain for Indeed.
But you might not know that.
Exactly.
It's close enough. And, yeah.
Exactly. Then it says slash view job and then a big scrambly bunch of characters, which all URLs, as I was groaning about last week, have. So you get this and it looks legitimate. I mean, you know, IndeedUS.org. It's not Indeed.com, but again, who would know? The email solicitation appears to be totally legitimate. I didn't actually read it, but I hope they have an English speaker in North Korea who's writing these. I'm sure they do. Anyway, victims who clicked on the links received by email would be served a hidden iframe that would trigger the exploit kit. And remember, normally you can click on things that are, I mean, you know, it's because, you know, our browsers are not designed to be vulnerable. So it's when there's a mistake, which the bad guys have leveraged, that clicking on something gets you in trouble. But clicking on something is, you know, is required almost all the time in order to make something happen. So victims who clicked on the email links would be served a hidden iframe that would trigger the exploit kit. Attacker-owned fake job domains were DisneyCareers.net, find-dreamjob.com, IndeedUS.org, VarietyJob.com, and ZipRecruiters.org.
So it's really close.
It's really close. Yeah. And you know, ZipRecruiters.org.
Plural, though, not now, singular. So that's the...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And once again, it's like it's enough that you even...
That's typo squatting right there.
Yes. Even if you were to scrutinize the URL, you know, you go, okay, yeah, ZipRecruiters.org. That's good. So they said a North Korean group whose activity has been publicly tracked as, this is the other one, Operation Apple Juice, targeted over 85 users in the cryptocurrency and financial tech industries leveraging the same exploit kit. This included compromising at least two legitimate financial tech company websites and hosting hidden iframes to serve the exploit kit to visitors. So you could go to a legitimate fintech website and get hit by this. In other cases, fake websites were observed, already set up to distribute Trojanized cryptocurrency applications, hosting iframes, and pointing their visitors to the exploit kit. And those sites were blockchainnews.vip, chainnews-star.com, financialtimes365.com, fireblocks.vip, gateexpiring.com, gbclabs.com, giantblock.org, hummingbot.io, onlynova.org, and teenbeanjs.com. And then those were the typo squatting sites. The two legitimate compromised websites between February 7th and 9th were www.options-it.com, a real site, and www.tradingtechnologies.com, another real site. The attackers made use of an exploit kit that contained multiple stages and components in order to exploit targeted users. The attackers placed links to the exploit kit within hidden iframes, which they embedded on both websites they owned as well as those two websites they compromised. The kit initially serves some heavily obfuscated JavaScript used to fingerprint the target system. This script, they wrote, collected all available client information, such as the user agent, the screen resolution, and all the other stuff that's available, and then sent it back to the exploitation server. If a set of unknown to them, because they had no way to know, requirements were met, meaning if that fingerprinting said, oh yes, this is a go, the client would be served a Chrome remote code execution exploit and some additional JavaScript. If the RCE was successful, and that's this first 0 day of the year, that's the Chrome RCE exploit. If that RCE was successful, the JavaScript would request the next stage referenced within the script as SBX, which is a common acronym for sandbox escape, because, of course, you got to get out of the browser sandbox. And they said, we unfortunately were unable to recover any of the stages that followed the initial RCE. Okay, and this is really interesting. The way the bad guys hide and protect themselves, being careful to protect their exploits, the attackers deployed multiple safeguards to make it difficult for security teams to recover any of the stages, which is why Google's team with, you know, absolute access to Chrome were unable to get anything any more than to learn of the first RCE. The safeguards include only serving the iframe at specific times, presumably when they knew an intended target would be visiting the site, which, like, think about that. So, like, it, the site is clean and doesn't contain the iframe except right at the time that they expect that their email will have been received and will likely be getting the click, if it's going to, that would bring the target back to the site. So a real narrow window during which that vulnerability is being sent to people who are entering the site. In some email campaigns, the targets received links with unique IDs. This was potentially used, they wrote, to enforce a one-time click policy for each link and allow the exploit kit only to be served once per targeted visitor. So again, even if you grab the email from somebody who received it, you cannot obtain the RCE by reusing the link that was already used once. The exploit kit would AES encrypt each stage, including the client's responses, with a session-specific key. So traffic sniffing won't work. And additional stages were not served if the previous stage failed. So all of that being done to tightly constrain the disclosure of the, for example, the sandbox escape. They know that because they saw it in the script that there was an SBX acronym. Presumably, the RCE was then followed by a sandbox escape. Google doesn't know what it is because they weren't unable to get it. Because the bad guys are being so careful not, you know, to tightly control and constrain the exploit chain step by step. And the second it's broken, it doesn't go any further. And as we said, using unique one-time only links, you're never able to begin to explore down that chain again. They said, although we recovered a new Chrome RCE, we also found evidence where the attackers specifically checked for visitors using Safari on macOS or Firefox on any OS and directed them to specific links on known exploitation servers. In other words, this set of exploits was for Chrome, but if somebody was coming in on Safari on a Mac or Firefox or using Firefox on any platform, they got their own exploits tuned to the environment that they were using. They said, we did not recover any responses from those URLs. So Google's tag team has extreme visibility via instrumentation into their own Chrome browser, but obviously not into other non-Chrome browsers. But this evidence strongly suggests that users of Safari on Mac and Firefox anywhere may have been served their own different browser-specific exploits. I have a link in the show notes, Leo, if you're curious. It's what VirusTotal thinks of the exploit kit that Google discovered. I told a friend of mine about VirusTotal, and because he had a questionable file, and like one obscure AV engine out of 70 thought there was a problem, and he got all freaked out. I said, no, Mark, it's okay. You know, that means nothing. But this thing lights up like a Christmas tree with how many? Yeah.
You know, they said 25 out of 20, 59.
Yeah. If you ever see 25 AV engines yeah. thinking that there's something wrong, don't go. Yeah. Don't proceed.
Kaspersky got it. So did Microsoft.
Yep. The attackers made multiple attempts to use the exploit. Now, this is interesting, too. The attackers made multiple attempts to use the exploit days after the vulnerability was patched on February 14th. And Google says, which stresses the importance of applying security updates as they become available. Well, I'm here to tell you, I keep complaining about this. I was using Chrome days after this thing was patched, and my Chrome wasn't patched. Yeah. It didn't patch itself until I went to look.
With Firefox, whenever Firefox gets updated, it says you can't use this, restart.
Yeah.
But Chrome doesn't do that, huh? That's weird.
Now, my Chrome usage, you know, I have Firefox open statically. I generally start and stop Chrome multiple times through the day.
So it should update.
So you'd really think it should. But it always is the case when I look, it goes, we got something. It's like, well, it would have been nice if you just did that for me.
Yeah.
So they protecting our users, they said, as part of our efforts, and this is something I wanted to share, as part of our efforts to combat serious threat actors, we use results from our research to improve the safety and security of our products. Upon discovery, all identified websites and domains were added to safe browsing to protect users from further exploitation. So that's one good thing that was done. Even if my Chrome hadn't updated itself, safe browsing would have protected me if my unsafe Chrome had tried to go to any of those places. They said, but of course, that also presumes that they have full visibility into all of the sites that were doing the exploiting, and they can never know that. They said, we also sent all targeted Gmail and Workspace users government-backed attacker alerts notifying them of the activity. As I said before, Google is good about notifying people to who they can that they may have been compromised. They said, we encourage any potential targets to enable enhanced safe browsing for Chrome and ensure that all devices are updated. They said, TAG is committed to sharing our findings as a way of raising awareness with the security community and with companies and individuals that might have been targeted or suffered from these activities. We hope that improving understanding of the tactics and techniques will enhance threat hunting capability and lead to stronger user protections across industry. So let's talk about enhanced safe browsing. We mentioned it before in passing, but I want to take this opportunity to talk about, you know, Google's like you know what they're doing. They said in 2020 we launched enhanced safe browsing, which you can turn on in your Chrome security settings with the goal of substantially increasing safety on the web. These improvements are being built on top of existing security mechanisms that already protect billions of devices. Since the initial launch, we have continuously worked behind the scenes to improve our real-time URL checks and apply machine learning models to warn on previously unknown attacks. As a result, enhanced safe browsing users are successfully phished 35% less than other users. Starting with Chrome 91, we will roll out new features to help enhance safe browsing users better choose their extensions, as well as offer additional protections against downloading malicious files on the web. Okay, so let's see, is there anything good here? Yeah. Every day, millions of people rely on Chrome extensions to help them be more productive, save money, shop, or simply improve their browser experience. This is why it's important for us to continuously improve the safety of extensions published in the Chrome Web Store. For instance, through our integration with Google Safe Browsing in 2020, the number of malicious extensions that Chrome disabled to protect users grew by 81%. This comes on top of a number of improvements for more peace of mind when it comes to privacy and security. Any extensions built by a developer who follows the Chrome Web Store developer platform policies will be considered trusted by enhanced safe browsing. For new developers, it will take at least a few months of respecting these conditions before becoming trusted. Eventually, we strive for all developers with compliant extensions to reach the status before meeting these criteria. Today, this represents nearly 75% of all extensions in the Chrome Web Store, but that means, you know, they said nearly 75. That means more than 25% don't. Let's see. And finally, under improved download protection, when you download a file, Chrome first performs a first-level check with Google Safe Browsing using metadata about the downloader file, such as the digest of the contents and the source of the file, to determine whether it's potentially suspicious. For any downloads that Safe Browsing deems risky but not clearly unsafe, enhanced Safe Browsing users will be presented with a warning and the ability to send the file to be scanned for a more in-depth analysis. If you choose to send the file, Chrome will upload it to Google Safe Browsing, which will scan it using its static and dynamic analysis classifiers in real time. After a short wait, if Safe Browsing determines the file is unsafe, Chrome will display a warning. As always, you can bypass the warning and open the file without scanning. Uploaded files are deleted from Safe Browsing a short time after scanning. Okay, so under Chrome's three-dot menu, you go to Settings in the drop-down menu. Then on the left of the page, you'll see Security and Privacy. Click on that. Then click on Security in the middle. You're now looking at the Safe Browsing choice. If you want it, as I would and do, simply click the Enhanced Protection button to enable Google's useful, and I named it here, Big Brother Overwatch feature set. You know, it is that. If you do this, then some of your surfing is being sent back in real time to Google for their verification. Well, the way I use Chrome, there's nowhere I'm going that I'm embarrassed for Google to know about. And so, and I mean, as the host of this podcast for so many years, I'm, you know, I'm becoming increasingly circumspect about the internet and about what's going on out there. And so sometimes I'm like trying, I'm looking for a DOS Ethernet driver for some motherboard's onboard Ethernet for, you know, working on SpinRite in order to do network debugging. And so I'm, you know, I'm going to some websites that look a little sketchy that are trying to get me to download their, we'll check all your drivers for free.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy to have Google, you know, watching where I go and making sure I don't step in something that I'll regret later. So I think our listeners probably fall into two categories. One is the, I don't want anybody watching me feeding anything back to the mothership. There are other users who probably think, yeah, I need the help. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that this enhanced browser protection is available. You can turn it on. I run with it on, and I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's – and a lot of browsers use Google's protection. They actually use that service. It's a service you can use in your browser.
Yep.
So, no, I think that's a good public service. Absolutely. Speaking of public services, you're the man. Thank you so much, Steve Gibson. Yet another fabulous Security Now. This is a show we do every Tuesday. It's kind of a must-listen for a lot of people every week. We're about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you wanted to watch or listen live, you could at live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, chat live at irc.twit.tv or in our Club Twit Discord. There's a lot of conversation going on in both places. After the fact, on-demand versions of the show are available from Steve directly at his site, grc.com. He has 16 kilobit audio versions for the bandwidth impaired, the normal 64 kilobit audio, and transcripts carefully crafted by Elaine Ferris. All that at grc.com. While you're there, pick up SpinRite 6.0, the world's finest mass storage maintenance and recovery utility, soon to be 6.1. Steve's working hard on that. You'll get a free upgrade if you buy now. grc.com. We have the show at our website, twit.tv/SN. There's a YouTube channel dedicated to it. And of course, you can subscribe free in any podcast client. Get it automatically the minute it's available. I think a lot of people collect all the episodes, all 864 of them. It's too bad you can't put it on your bookshelf.
I know they do because I watch it happening in my server's bandwidth.
Yeah, the old ones.
I want them all.
Yeah. It's awesome. We will be back next Tuesday, Steve. I hope you will too. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Bye.
The world is changing rapidly. So rapidly, in fact, that it's hard to keep up. That's why Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, talk with the people making and breaking the tech news on Tech News Weekly every Thursday. They know these stories better than anyone. So why not get them to talk about it in their own words? Subscribe to Tech News Weekly and you won't miss a beat every Thursday at twit.tv. Security.